Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Germs, they're all around us. Most of us don't know much about them, but we fear them and go out of our way, sometimes to extremes, to avoid them. Today we're going to explore the history of Americans' obsession with germs. But before we do that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1785, one of America's best-known artists was born. With a passion for nature and the creatures that inhabit it, he created a body of work that now stands as an invaluable piece of North American environmental history. Born in Haiti and educated in France, John James Audubon came to the United States in 1803 to establish himself in business. Yet his interest in natural history led him to employment as a taxidermist with a private museum. By 1820, he was so taken by an excursion down the Mississippi River collecting wildlife specimens that he decided to devote himself exclusively to the pictorial documentation of America's native birds and animals. That led to his most famous collection of paintings, The Birds of America, a five-volume series completed in 1838. Turning to items of interest in the news, German and Austrian banks recently took another hit in the latest legal settlement involving the claims of Holocaust survivors. Kreditanstalt and Bank Austria agreed to pay $40 million and hand over reams of documents in a class action lawsuit alleging the bank both aided and profited from Nazi genocide. Most significantly, however, is not the monetary settlement, but instead the volumes of documents that Jewish leaders plan to use as ammunition in future legal claims against other German and Austrian companies. In Washington, D.C., a few scars from the Vietnam War have begun to heal. The Pentagon recently identified the remains of three more U.S. servicemen who have been listed as missing from the war. They were Navy Commander John C. Mapp, Air Force Major John E. Bailey, and Navy Petty Officer Second Class John F. Hartzheim. Over 1,000 U.S. servicemen are still considered missing in action. You're listening to Talking History. Is there really a gospel of germs? Maybe. But what is it? Where did it come from? What role does it play in American life? We have with us today one person who actually knows all about that gospel. She's Nancy Toms, and here to speak to Dr. Toms is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan.
The roots of disease, we are told, are all around us. Dust mites live in our carpets, salmonella lurks on our countertops, and who knows what's on the case of that rented video. Looking at American advertising today, one might think that we are obsessed with microbes. How did we get to this point? With us to discuss the origins of American germ phobia is Dr. Nancy Toms, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and author of The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. Welcome, Dr. Toms. Have Americans always been so conscious of germs, or as you say in your book, so antiseptic conscious?
No, absolutely not. We don't have to go back very far in American history till about 1870 to get to a point where the average American had absolutely no awareness that there was such a thing as a germ and acted in ways that we would find really horrifying.
So how did people get to this point?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the scientific piece of it. The discovery in the debate starts in the 1860s. Explaining certain kinds of diseases as the work of invisible microorganisms. It was a very controversial theory for many years, and it took that amount of time for the scientists to debate it and essentially to agree that it was indeed true, and then to start public education programs to acquaint the average person that these little beasties existed.
Now, what is the gospel of germs?
Well, that's a phrase I came up with to talk about those public health campaigns that were designed to acquaint average people, not scientists, not even wealthy people often, that germs did exist. And the reason I use the word gospel is that they had a kind of religious fervor. They knew a truth. They were converted to the truth of the germ theory of disease, and they were very eager to spread that conviction to everybody they met, because they felt that people knew about germs, they would act in ways that could save their lives and the lives of their children.
What diseases were they worried about?
Well, in the 19th century, the most common causes of death were, in fact, communicable diseases. Tuberculosis was the number one killer in the 19th century. There were many diseases that affected children under the age of five, so many parents watched helplessly as their infants and their small children died of things like whooping cough and diphtheria, things we now have immunizations against.
Which one did these public health and education programs take?
Well, in the beginning, they used sort of traditional means of influencing public opinion from the olden days, lectures and sermons and pretty dry kinds of methods. But around the turn of the century, the converts to the gospel of germs began to be influenced by methods from modern advertising and other forms of mass communication, mass propaganda. So they, in fact, borrowed a leaf from Madison Avenue, and they started to make public health messages look like product advertisements, and that was much more effective in terms of getting the word out.
How did the gospel of germs affect women's dress and even how men wore their beards?
Oh, that was one aspect I found really fascinating in my research, that the drive to rid the body and the home of potentially germ-catching appendages. So after years of women reformers trying to get women's skirts shortened for health reasons because they were so heavy and it kind of weighed women down, they didn't have much luck when they used just that health argument. But around the 1890s, scientists take the hems of ladies' skirts and culture them, you know, put the dust in a little petri dish and get all kinds of bacteria off them. And lo and behold, that really did the trick. Women's skirt lengths really started going up as more and more of them became aware that the dirt they were picking up on their hems had germs in them. With the men, it was the realization largely through the rise of modern surgery that we have a lot of germs in our hair, and that men's beards then were colonizing these germ, the germ threat. So men were told they needed to shave to keep their wives and children safe.
And how did this affect home decor as well?
Oh, it's amazing. Probably many of your listeners are familiar with the classic Victorian overstuffed look. They left no surface uncovered. Everything was very dense and textured. Well, when the germ gospelers come along, they say this is just germ heaven, and encourage American housewives to strip their homes down. So if you look at a picture of an average American home in 1880 versus 1920, you'll notice the stripping down, much as they did with their bodies, they also did with their homes. Wicker, for example, was seen as healthier than upholstery. They got rid of wall-to-wall carpets. You had to have a wood floor and area rugs that could be cleaned because the germs got in the carpet, so forth.
So could we say that there's a connection between the gospel of germs and even the arts and crafts movement?
Definitely. I mean, it's not the only reason. I don't want to suggest that germs were the only motivation, but it was a big piece of it, was the sense that the home would be healthier if these simpler styles of furniture were adopted.
How did business latch on to Americans' concern about germs?
Oh, this is again, something that really impressed me, that almost from the minute that the scientists began to take germs seriously, American entrepreneurs saw a potential to latch on to this new threat and to use it to sell things. I have found commercial brochures and advertisements, even from 1880, and this is at a point when physicians are still really debating the germ theory of disease, and there are already entrepreneurs out there trying to use the germ to sell different kinds of household attachments, disinfectants. In the beginning, there was a lot of attention to toilets. It was thought that your toilet created this doorway for germs to come up out of the sewer. So toilet attachments were a big item in the early days.
Yes. Could you describe for us the germicide?
The germicide was a little box that you attached to the back of your toilet that dripped disinfectant down into the toilet water to create an antiseptic barrier between you and the dangerous sewer gas, they called it. They thought that sewers were a place where dangerous disease germs were percolating, and that every time you used your toilet, you were creating an access for them to come into your home, so you had to buy a germicide to drip the disinfectant in there and to kill them.
And even the toilets became white.
Yes.
Why is that so?
The white bathroom was very much tied up with this cleanliness campaign in the home to strip down the bathroom and turn it into a place that could be disinfected very easily. Victorian bathrooms, like the parlors, were furnished with carpets and draperies and heavy wallpaper. Well, this was just, hygiene, a horror to the reformers, so they convinced people to put in white tile, white toilets, because then you could see very easily if there was any filth, as they called it, lurking in your toilet bowl.
How did the gospel of germs also help refrigerator sales?
Yes, that one of the implications as the scientists began to understand how germs got into people's bodies, is they realized that the food supply was a major source or major conduit into the home. And that as they experimented with microbial life, they realized you could either, if you made it very, very hot, you could kill most of them, but you could also retard their growth if you kept things cold. So the use of ice boxes to keep food at cold temperature was introduced, in part to keep the food from spoiling, but also when they began to realize the role of germs in the kitchen, also to retard the growth of microbes in your food.
One of the most interesting products you talk about is Listerine. Could you tell us about the early days of that product?
Well, Listerine was introduced as a all-purpose household disinfectant. It was named after the famous surgeon, Joseph Lister, who invented antiseptic surgery. So they were honoring him. There were a lot of disinfectants either named after Lister, or then there would be ones named after Pasteur, Louis Pasteur, the great French exponent of the germ theory. Listerine in the early days was meant as this kind of all-purpose disinfectant. It was common in this time period that you didn't use a disinfectant the way we would today. They would advocate basically taking more or less a bath in it, injecting it into your body, washing your hair with it, sometimes bathing your pets because they were frightened that germs were on the fur of your cat and your dog, so you were supposed to use it to dip the dog. It was amazing.
How did the gospel of germs also affect the role and status of housewives?
Well, it was certainly, although the gospel was not directed just at women, men were encouraged to fight the germ by shaving and taking care of the family plumbing. On a day-to-day basis, the real work on the front line against the germ was the work of women, of wives and mothers. And there was a great deal of emphasis placed in the late 19th and early 20th century on a mother's duty to protect her children by keeping her home absolutely free of germs.
How did the gospel then move from the private to the public sphere, for example, from the home to hotels or restaurants?
Well, it's the once, especially Americans who were wealthier and who traveled and who ate out, once they became convinced of the germ threat, they wanted the same kind of safety that they had in their own home when they went out. So hotels particularly were in a really difficult position in the late 19th century. Remember, the rates of communicable disease are very high, so the chances that in any given hotel there was someone staying there who had, for example, tuberculosis were very high. And it meant that if, as Americans became more germ-phobic, they wanted hotels to protect them against the germs of other guests. And one example I found in my research, it's one of the most bizarre things, was the 8 or 9 foot sheet I had never thought to myself, why is it that that hotel rooms have such long sheets and they fold them back over the blanket? That, in fact, is a custom that originated in this time period. They were worried that the blanket particularly, which was hard to wash, might have the germs of tuberculosis on it, and what you would do is fold the sheet back to protect the sleeper from the germs that some previous guest might have deposited there.
And is this also the origin of the cake of soap that one always finds in the hotel room?
Indeed. You had to have your own soap. You had to have everything hygienically fresh every time a new guest checked in. So having your own soap, having towels that were boiled after you used them, the kind of niceties that especially American hotels excel at, were very much came out of this hygiene revolution.
What was the effect of the gospel of germs upon minorities and immigrants?
Well, it wasn't a terribly good effect in some ways, in that at the time the germ theory became popularized at the turn of the century, there were very high rates of immigration from Europe to the United States, and then around the time of World War I, you began to have African Americans moving up from the South to the North, and this was not a time period distinguished for its liberal views toward non-Native Americans. So immigrants and Black Americans both got equated as germ carriers. And so there was a lot of prejudice expressed toward them.
One of the more interesting stories, too, in your book is the tale of the White House plumbers, and it doesn't have anything to do with Nixon. What about this story?
That was really one of the most bizarre things I came across. The fact that at one point in our past, Congress, that the House actually passed a bill calling for the White House to be torn down and a new sanitary replica put up in its place. It's just astounding. But this goes back to the fear of the toilet that developed in this time period. It even predates the germ theory, and I should point that out, that people had become concerned about sewers and toilets before they knew about microbes. They just got more worried about it when they found out about the germ theory. The idea that what is coming out of the sewer can literally poison you, like we would think of radon or some gas coming out. They were very frightened of the plumbing. The White House had notoriously bad plumbing systems dating back. It was built in the early 18th century, and the plumbing was not terribly good. And after President Garfield was shot, he was taken to he was a victim of an assassination attempt. He survived it. He was shot in July of 1882. And they didn't take people to hospitals in the same way they do today. They took him to the White House. And he did not do well. He developed a fever, and we today would attribute it to the gunshots and the infection from the gunshots, but at the time there was real concern that he was being poisoned by the White House plumbing.
Well, we only have a moment left, but perhaps you could tell us about the legacy of the gospel of germs and how it affects our society today.
Well, I don't think it's ever gone away since it first became the gospel at the turn of the century, but it certainly lost a lot of its intensity after the introduction of antibiotics in the starting in the late 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, the need to be so careful about germs diminished when there were drugs that you could easily prescribe to get rid of especially bacterial infections. So we enter a period in my childhood particularly when people were not so concerned about germs. I mean, they were kind of a minor affliction. You were more worried about other things. But since the 1980s, and certainly the AIDS epidemic has been a big piece of this, and also other changing disease patterns, we're much more aware now of infectious diseases, that they've not gone away, that they're still there. And as a result, Americans today are much more germ conscious than they were 20 years ago.
What was your reaction to that advertising campaign about you can't get AIDS by touching toilets and doorknobs?
Well, what it reminded me was how good a job the reformers I was looking at have done, because they really have made ordinary people aware that you can that germs exist and that they're common ways that they're transmitted. The problem is that the way a cold is transmitted is not the same as the way AIDS is transmitted. And people get confused. You don't catch AIDS from a drinking cup. And yet there's a lot of misinformation and needless anxiety about AIDS because people are still operating with these older rules that don't apply to this particular disease.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Toms.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Nancy Toms, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and author of The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life.
Nostalgia often involves memories of happier, healthier days when we all lived cleaner, simpler lives without the threat of the infections and diseases modern life has wrought. Here to set the record straight on that myth is David Rossner. Dr. Rossner is co-director of the program in the history of public health and medicine at the Joseph L. Melman School of Public Health at Columbia University in New York City.
It is dangerous to lament the passing of supposedly golden eras and to characterize the present as a period of decline and disintegration, as the history of disease in our great cities all too clearly illustrates. When we put aside our current and very specific fears of urban violence, homelessness, poverty, tuberculosis, or AIDS, we can see sides of the modern city that reflect its continuing vibrancy and even hope. For many in the middle and late decades of the 19th century, whose memories of urban life stretch back a few decades, recent change augured both possibilities and problems. On the one hand, the American city was obviously emerging as the preeminent center of commerce, culture, and wealth in the nation. On the other hand, the poverty, illness, crowding, and foreignness of the city appeared frightening. To older, largely Protestant New Yorkers, for example, it was difficult to deny the connection between the arrival of millions of new immigrants from rural Europe and the growing number of plagues that swept across the nation. Nor was it possible to avoid incorporating nativist beliefs into programs aimed at controlling disease. Smallpox, cholera, typhoid, yellow fever, and a host of intestinal diseases in the young and old alike accompanied the recognition of poverty, population increase, and immigrants. By mid-century, vital statistics gathered showed that one out of every 44 people died in Boston and one of 40 in Philadelphia. New York's rate was 1 in 36. Even when compared with European centers such as London and Liverpool, American cities fared badly. In 1865, just as the Civil War was ending and shortly following New York's infamous draft riots, the Association of New York issued a report on the sanitary condition of the city. Dedicated to the benefit of all classes in the city, the report provided over 300 pages of detailed descriptions of the city's physical, social, and moral character. Beginning with the observation that pestilential diseases laid bare the impotence of the existing sanitary system, the report noted that outbreaks of disease paralyzed the commercial and political life of the community. The recent war had illustrated only too clearly that living conditions directly affected people's health. Reformatory efforts, whether social or political, they said, or exclusively moral and religious, were of paramount necessity in light of the disorders that had threatened the city's stability. The streets were filthy with accumulations of manure from horses that traversed the area, dead dogs, cats and rats, household and vegetable refuse that in winter accumulated to depths of 3 feet or more. City streets literally rose anywhere from 3 feet to 6 feet a year before spring cleaning when men with shovels moved through a neighborhood. Vigorous public health campaigns were organized aimed at cleaning up the streets, and in but one generation, health statistics began to rise substantially. By the early 20th century, fewer children were dying. Adults began to live longer. Pestilential disease began to wane. All of this before antibiotics or the advances of modern medicine. The dramatic improvement in the health status that accompanied the various campaigns to clean up urban America were born of an incredible belief that human action and government activities could dramatically improve our health and lives. Ironically, it is the terrible price of cynicism that today, despite our enormous wealth, our incredible technologies, and tremendous resources as the leading economic engine of the world, that we have abandoned all hope of improving the lives of others or even of protecting our own well-being by harnessing our energies to reform our society through our own collective action. perhaps an accurate memory of our past and our ability even a century ago to reorganize our lives may provide us with some hope for the future.
You've been listening to David Rossner, co-director of the Program in the History of Public Health and Medicine at the Joseph L. Nelman School of Public Health at Columbia University in New York City. This is Talking History. Welcome back. Following up on our interview with Nancy Toms, we've chosen as our site of the week a recently opened museum exhibit on the history of infectious diseases. Here to tell you more about the exhibit is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The American Museum of Natural History presents Epidemic, the World of Infectious Disease, and it runs through September 6. Using dioramas, three-dimensional models, films, interactive computer stations, and photographs, the exhibit explores the biological and ecological factors that influence the causes, spread, and control of infectious diseases and investigates how different cultures fight them. For more information, contact the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. First, we call to your attention Strong Medicine, the Century of High Desert Remedies, an exhibit at the High Desert Art Museum in Bend, Oregon, which runs through May 16th. It features many instruments and remedies of early medical practice in the Northwest. For further information, contact the High Desert Museum in Bend, Oregon. And for those of you who've had just about enough of the history of medicine, we recommend the exhibit Searching for Ancient Egypt, just opened at the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha, Nebraska. Searching for Ancient Egypt, organized by the University of Pennsylvania Museum and the Dallas Museum of Art, contains 138 artifacts on 3,000 years of art, architecture, and daily life in ancient Egypt. For more information, contact the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha, Nebraska. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we'll discuss the history behind the recent crisis in Russia. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.